Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now a white author who wants other white people, including white liberals, to be less fragile when it comes to difficult conversations about race. Robin DiAngelo has been a consultant and trainer on issues of racial and social justice for more than 20 years and was a tenured professor of multicultural education at Westfield State University in Massachusetts. Her new book is called White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. Dr. DiAngelo, thank you for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why fragility? Mm-hmm. Why that word?
You know, it captures a dynamic, and it has resonated with so many people. And so I think as soon as you hear it, you kind of know what I'm talking about. The fragility part sometimes gets a little misunderstood. So white people are really fragile in the sense of how defensive we are and how easy it is to trigger the defensiveness, right? So for a lot of white people, right now, the fact that I'm generalizing about white people, that I'm proceeding as if I could know something about somebody just because they're white, that being white has meaning, suggesting those things will trigger a lot of umbrage and defensiveness. But that defensiveness is not fragile at all in its impact. It's a pretty effective way to push off challenges to our racial comfort and maintain our positions within a deeply unequal society.
So to engage what you said, that some of the listeners' reactions even to the title might be, if when you talk about people of color, it's offensive to talk about them as a group. Black people do this, Indian people do that, whatever. Then why is it okay to talk about white people that way?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because you know you're going to get an email that says that. We have this idea that if everybody gets the same thing, then that's fair. And that doesn't account for differentials in power and resources and access to resource. So for people of color, it's actually really refreshing and important interruption to the way racism works to acknowledge their individuality, right? But for white people who are always have the privilege of being individuals, it's actually really healthy to grapple with what it means to be part of this group, because you could literally predict whether I was going to survive my birth and how long I'm going to live based on my racial categorization. And as a sociologist, I'm really comfortable generalizing about groups because social life is patterned and predictable in observable ways.
In your chapter called Racial Triggers for White People, you write, within their insulated environment of racial privilege, whites both expect racial comfort and become less tolerant of racial stress. I think this is a central concept in the book. What do you mean by racial comfort and racial stress?
Well, I move through the world in a society in which I'm racially comfortable virtually 24/7. It's rare for me to be outside of my racial comfort zone. And most of my life, I've been warned not to get outside of my racial comfort zone, you know, warned away from spaces that are inhabited primarily by people of color and black people in particular. And I move through a society where I'm centered and affirmed and my image is everywhere and every teacher I ever had. I could get through grad school and never look up and not see myself reflected at the front of the room. And so that kind of insular, reflected, represented experience, I come to feel not only entitled to it, but that to interrupt that is some kind of terrible social breach.
So should it be a goal, in your opinion, for white people to become more comfortable with discomfort when it comes to race? Do you see that to some degree to be a tough but necessary step toward broader social justice and more comfort for people of color?
Absolutely. Yes, we need to build our capacity.
How does less comfort lead to more comfort?
Because we need to build our capacity. There's no way we're going to challenge the racial construct in this country from a place of white comfort. You know, racism's not comfortable, and it's not an isolated moment as we've been taught to see it. It circulates 24/7, 365. And so to break with the status quo, I'm going to have to get unsettled. And as I build the capacity to sustain that, I'm going to be able to engage in much more constructive, cross-racial conversations and keep racism on the table in my institutions. And eventually, ideally, that will lead to more comfort for everybody.
And so part of that must be that white people in America, like most majorities anywhere, don't realize that people in minority populations are constantly reminded of their minority status.
And also constantly making themselves smaller or turning themselves in knots, not to trigger our fragile sensibilities, you know, not to make white people uncomfortable. I'll be asked to go into an overwhelmingly white organization that is having trouble recruiting and retaining people of color. And I'll be warned, but don't say white. You know, it's just kind of this very ridiculous desire to protect white people's comfort.
My guest is Robin DiAngelo, whose new book is called White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. Any white people want to engage with this conversation? Are you having strong reactions to this? Positive, negative, mixed? Want to engage with Dr. DiAngelo? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. One of the central concepts of your book is getting beyond what you call the good-bad binary. Can you explain the good-bad binary?
Yeah, you know, the system of racism is a highly adaptive system, and it adapted to the challenges of the civil rights movement by reducing the idea of a racist to a very simple formula. It's always an individual, not a system. It must be conscious, and it must be intentional, right? So a racist is an individual who doesn't like people based on race, knows that, and wants to be mean to them. And that definition, that simplistic definition, exempts virtually all white people from the system we're in, and I think is the root of virtually all white defensiveness. You know, you suggest anything I've said or done is racially problematic, and I will actually hear that you've just questioned my very moral character, and now I'm going to need to defend my moral character. So we see racists as bad and not racists as good, and if we see ourselves as good, nice, well-intentioned people, we believe we cannot be racist. We don't understand what racism is.
What is racism?
Racism is the system we're in. It's the water we're all swimming in. It's the bedrock of our institutions, our policies, practices, norms, language. And none of us could be exempt from its forces. It, you know, the research in implicit bias is actually really, really helpful because, well, also the current climate, as we're done with the post-racial narrative. It's very clear that we're not post-racial. But it's also very clear that almost all of the biases that drive our actual actions are not at the conscious level. But across my life, I've been relentlessly given messages that to be white is inherently better. I couldn't miss those messages. And children by age 3 to 4, the research shows, understand that it's better to be white in this country.
So further to that point, you address in the book politically progressive whites directly at various points. For example, you write that in diversity trainings, progressive whites may not respond with anger as much as more conservative whites, but might still insulate themselves, like with claims that they don't need this, they already know this. But you call that another form of white fragility.
You know, this is racism is arguably the most complex, nuanced, and sensitive and charged system since the beginning of this country. We should never consider our learning to be over. I will never fully understand this and never fully recognize the degree in which I've internalized it. So this certitude, this arrogance that so many progressive have, you know, that just basically there's nothing more I need to engage with because I'm finished. You know, I've been to Costa Rica and I have multiracial, you know, nieces and nephews. I mean, this is the kind of evidence that white progressives give for a lack of racism. And it's actually pretty thin and not remotely convincing to people of color.
One chapter of your book, and I wonder what kind of reaction you've been getting to it, if the book has been out long enough for this, is called White Women's Tears. And it's about white women crying in the context of difficult interracial interactions early on in the chapter, you tell a story, of one training you were running in which you actually asked your fellow white people, women in particular, if they needed to cry to please leave the room. Can you put that request in context?
You know, our behaviors are political in the sense that there's a history that we bring. And another part of being raised as a white person is not to see ourselves as bringing the history of our group with us. We tend to see ourselves as individuals. But there's a very deep history of terrorism, quite frankly, towards black people in this country based on white women's claims of racial stress or distress. I mean, Emmett Till is a tragic example. And we invoke that history when we cry. We also invoke lots of people's socialization to run and rescue us. And what happens is the white woman who's shedding tears in the conversation becomes the victim, and whatever triggered those tears, would it be a story or feedback, quite frankly, on something this person said that was problematic, that person is now the transgressor. You know, again, it doesn't have to be intentional, but those tears trigger other people's responses and reactions, and so we need to be thoughtful about them. Our hearts do need to break. I mean, I think as white people, we need to ask ourselves, why aren't our hearts breaking at the racism that we see all around us? But where, how, when we express that grief, we have to be really thoughtful about.
Dr. Robin DiAngelo, my guest, with her new book, White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism, and Keith and Edison. You're on WNYC with Dr. DiAngelo. Hi, Keith.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, so I did have a kind of a statement and a question to ask, because I hear it all the time about how, like, white people are racist and we should be mindful of that, and it's a group identity kind of thing, and, you know, if you don't realize it, you know, you're part of the problem, and, you know, people of color and minority, they can't be racist. And I just don't see how that's logical, because every day I come across more and more people that seem to show either racism or kind of some sort of prejudice toward my own self, and like to classify myself as one of those people just because of my skin color. And I think that in today's political climate, that this has become more and more of a kind of issue, or, you know, things that people just kind of go with in order to, like, silence the individual or stay away from actual conversation and dialogue between one another. And I think that talking about how racism is this and that is just detrimental, and it's not actually solving any issues. Instead, it's just kind of keeping the wound open and not actually moving forward as a country or as a society.
Let me get a response, Dr.
Well, I would agree, actually, that it's not logical to suggest, right, that you could be part of a racist system or have racist patterns if you define racism as individual acts of intentional meanness. That is not the definition I'm using. And as we can see, that definition keeps us locked into this either-or kind of idea. So again, I would agree that it's offensive for me to suggest you're racist when I don't know you, if our definition of a racist is what I just said.
So is your definition that we live in a racist system, there is much structural racism, and any white people, which would be basically every white people person more or less, who benefits from that structural racism is therefore racist? Or is that unfairly attributing a characteristic to a person as an individual?
Well, the messages of white superiority are raining down on us relentlessly, and we can't be exempt from them. We don't have umbrellas, if you will. And it behooves us to really look deeply at these messages and notice them. And there's another, the first chapter of my book talks about the challenges of talking to white people about racism. And, you know, the first one is what we even think it is. But another one is, everybody has an opinion on racism. You can't grow up in this country and not develop an opinion on racism, but that doesn't make it informed. And so when we don't grapple with those deeper questions, we just rehearse the worldview we already have, we hold it in place, and we protect it.
Beth in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question for Dr. D'Angelo, or Ms. D'Angelo. I'm sorry, I didn't catch a title. In terms of whenever I'm a white person, and whenever I try to engage other white people in my life about these conversations about racism as you define it, structural racism and white privilege and how we benefit from it, I get this numb, silent response. I don't get the angry conservative response that you mentioned. I don't get the progressive, I already know this. I just get nothing. And I don't know what approach to take to move the conversation forward and to engage people, you know, without feeling myself enraged that I'm like, you know, dancing on eggshells around other white people, which drives me insane. So I don't know what approach to take. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, thank you. You know, so two thoughts come to mind. One, of course, is white solidarity. And I define that as the unspoken agreement amongst white people that we'll keep each other comfortable around racism. We won't, you know, I'd rather you not feel uncomfortable. So I'll just listen to something you've said that's racist. And I don't think anyone at the dinner table with old Uncle Bob knows this dynamic. And when you break with white solidarity, when you don't kind of protect white people's insular worldviews, again, it's a social breach. And so when you talk about racism the way that you do, you're breaking with white solidarity. And there's a range of responses. Well, now we've identified three, right? Anger, I already know all this, and silence. But the question that I always ask myself is, how do these responses function? And silence functions just like all the other ones function. It blocks them from having to grapple with something deeply unsettling. So I'm hoping that when you bring it up with white people that you ask questions. One strategy I use is I try to point my finger inward, not outward, right? I kind of own my own so that I'm not, you know, people don't feel accused and if they can relate to what I'm saying. But also, it's hard to look at you in silence if you've just asked an open question.
Dr. Robin D'Angelo has just opened some questions that maybe some of you haven't thought about before with her book, White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. Thank you so much for coming here and talking about it with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
The Brian Lehrer Show is produced today by Lisa Allison, Mary Croak, Amina Cerna, and Jeremy House. Megan Ryan is the head of live radio. Our interns today are Christopher Hickey, Catherine Troutwine, and Naila Andre. And we had Matt Morando and Leora Noam Kravitz at the audio controls. Follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer and on Facebook at Brian Lehrer WNYC.